Back here on the Mitch Albom program all across the United States. It was 25 years ago today, sort of paraphrase Sergeant Pepper's, that John Lennon was killed outside his apartment building, the Dakota, in New York City. And there are all kinds of commemorations going on today and people remembering John Lennon. And we had a chance to talk with Cynthia Lennon a few weeks back upon the release of her book, John, which recalled their years together when she was his wife and their children. And we didn't really get a chance to finish our conversation with her. And I thought on this sad but interesting day to commemorate John Lennon, we would invite her back to continue that conversation. And she was kind enough to do so. Hello, Cynthia.
Hi, Mitch.
Thanks again for coming back one more time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
By review, we spoke a lot in our last conversation about how you and John had met, the art classes that you were taking, the beginning of the Beatles, and then unfortunately we sort of had to break off there. I'd like to sort of pick up when the Beatles began to get really famous and large and beyond belief. Some of the experiences that you shared with John and perhaps his feeling about the largeness of the Beatles' fame, because he, amongst the four of them, always seemed to cast the most cynical eye on how big the Beatles were becoming. Can you talk about what you observed with him during that period?
Well, I think right from the beginning, John was very special. I think we, even in those early days, college and at the Cavern and when they went to Hamburg and everything else, he was always a bit of a leader, and he was always very confident in his future. But, you know, you should always be careful of what you dream of, because it will surely be yours. And I think the dream that actually came about was the fact that they did become, and he did become, very, very important in this world of music. And I think the fact that they were so famous, that they were so adored, made him feel very trapped at a certain point in his life, even though it gave us both and everybody else lots and lots of money, lots and lots of adoration, lots and lots of fans. It was a situation where he could not be himself unless he was in front of an audience. In fact, when he came home, he was usually so exhausted, so tired. So, in fact, an awful lot of his music relates to the fact that he was tired, leave me alone, I'm sleeping, that kind of thing, help, I need somebody. All that kind of thing crashed in on him at a point when they were at their peak, their absolute peak.
When he did come home, and he was there with you and your family, how did he sort of shut out the Beatles? Did he have sort of, we're not talking about music, we're not talking about, I'm not taking phone calls. Was there any way to keep that outside world from coming into your home life?
Well, yes, he had we had a housekeeper called Dot, who was very good at fending off virtually everybody. Of course, we had the usual sort of electric gates that nobody could come into our home. But we would leave, say, to go to the studio or to go out or whatever, and there would be about 15 or 20 fans. This is out in the country in Surrey, camping out outside. So there was no real escape from it. You know, even though you could go to bed at night and sleep and try and be normal about the situation, as soon as you opened your front gate, you know, it was on your doorstep.
I imagine that took its toll on your relationship, just the tension of that.
Well, I think it would on anybody's, really. It wasn't a natural or normal sort of relationship. I think our natural, normal relationship was when we were students, really. And I think as soon as the fame took over and the money kept rolling in, I think that was the time when we realized that, you know, our lives were not our own.
Did in the early years, 64, 65, when it was really white hot, did John and you feel that it was just going to pass? I mean, up till that point, bands didn't stay that famous for that long. And did you figure by 67 or 68, they'd be on to somebody else?
you know, in hindsight, you would think that you would think like that, but you don't, because it's happening so quickly and you're living for the moment and you never know what's around the corner. And we didn't. I mean, that was 6 years of absolute... well, it was magical, but it was also life-changing and amazing. I mean, we couldn't possibly imagine what was going to happen to us. You know, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen to me tomorrow. It's one of the... But when you're in that situation, you know, when the whole world is clamoring for you and you're on every in every record store, on every bookshelf, it was really quite... Well, not bizarre, but unbelievable. That's all I can say. Everywhere people stare,
each and every day. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
I can see them laugh at me, and I hear them say, hey, you've got to hide your love away.
I remember the famous comment, or infamous comment now, that he said, we're bigger than Jesus. And the storm that created. Tell us about that comment. What do you think he meant by it, and the firestorm that came afterwards?
Well, I think what John was always very honest and blunt, you know, in what he said. When he was asked a question, he would answer it the way he felt it and saw it as it was at the time. And what he meant actually was the fact that, you know, not many people were going to church, but many, many millions of fans were clamoring for the Beatles and buying records, music. He didn't mean it in any derogatory way against any religion. I mean, that was the way John was. But, I mean, the shock to him and everybody around him at the time was very, very... It was horrible. We were horrified at what was happening in the States. I mean, the thought of people burning, the Ku Klux Klan, the whole situation was abominable.
Well, some teenagers have repeated your statements that the Beatles, I like the Beatles more than Jesus Christ. What do you think about that?
Well, originally I was pointed out that fact in reference to England, that we meant more to kids than Jesus did, or religion at that time. I wasn't knocking it or putting it down, I was just saying it as a fact. And it is... true, especially more for England than here. You know, I'm not saying that we're better or greater or comparing us with Jesus Christ as a person or God as a thing or whatever it is. You know, I just said what I said and it was wrong or was taken wrong and now it's all this.
Bear with us if you would, Cynthia. We're going to take a brief break. Cynthia Lennon, our guest here, her book about her time with John Lennon, John, out in bookstores now. We'll continue here on the Mitch Albom Program. So this is
Christmas. I'd like to live to a ripe old age, and I'm not afraid of dying. I don't know how I'd feel at the moment, but I'm prepared for death because I don't believe in it. I think it's just getting out of one car and getting into another. And you won't just be gone. Album! It's been a hard day's night, and she's got a ticket to ride.
Well, we're continuing our conversation here on the Mitch Albom Program with Cynthia Lennon, who is not only the former wife of John Lennon, she wrote a book about her years together with John called John, and this today, December 8th, the 25th anniversary of the death of John Lennon outside his apartment building, shot to death in New York City. There's been a lot in the news lately about how John really felt about his songwriting vis-a-vis Paul McCartney. A lot of stuff that was brought up by Yoko Ono and comments that apparently John made in a 1970 interview with Rolling Stone about what he felt about Paul's contributions or things like that. During the process that you were with him all through the 60s, did he relate any frustration about his songwriting versus Paul's, the way it was received, etc.?
No, not at all. They were a family. We were all a family at that time. They loved each other. They worked together. In fact, I've read articles by Paul recently saying, you know, he was my best mate. And that's what I saw. That's what I felt. We were all our best mates at the time. So whatever came afterwards, I mean, I will never forget John saying, you know, that Julian was born out of a bottle of whiskey on a Saturday night. That's the sort of comment that John would make when he was in a tight corner. And I think with his life with Yoko, he had to sort of deny an awful lot of the things that he truly felt in the early days to make peace or to make someone feel better.
But why would putting down Paul McCartney make Yoko Ono feel better?
Well, it would make her feel more a part of him, because Paul was a very strong partner of John's on the creative side. You know, and that artists have problems, you know, sometimes their egos become too big for themselves. Paul and John, they had their own egos, but they balanced each other out.
Help, I need somebody. Help, can buy me love.
Had their egos. We've all got egos. But, you know,
right. Well, that actually leads me to a question regarding you, because here you were his wife, and he had this dear mate, as you say, in Paul McCartney, and a creative yin and yang. Did you ever feel a sense of jealousy for the relationship that he had with Paul?
Well, I think I never ever felt jealous of Paul or their relationship, because I was there right from the beginning, because they were schoolboys when John and I were in college, because they used to come in and practice their guitars and their chords and everything else in the early days when they were 18 and 19, even younger. I mean, there was nothing that I could possibly feel against any of them, because, you know, they were a team. Mm-hmm. And that's what they've proved, that they were a fantastic band, and they, you know, conquered the world in many ways. How could you possibly be jealous of that?
Were you there for any of the songwriting? Did John write at night at home? Did Paul come over? Were you around when they constructed any of the songs that now our audience would consider classic Beatles songs?
Well, they were always doing it. They were always at it. They were always, Paul would either come over to us, or John would go over to Paul. They were always scribbling, you know, lyrics and notes and practicing on the guitars, playing the piano. I mean, it was happening all the time. The problem is that it's not a problem, but I was there for so much of it. You know, we'd go into the studios. You know, and at the end of their doing their demo discs or whatever they were doing, or finishing a song off, you know, we would go in later and hear it. I mean, so it was part and parcel of our souls and our lives at the time.
Hold on. 1, 2, 3. Ooh. You're daft, yes.
Oh, it's one of the four.
1, 2, 3, 4. Ooh.
Was John more oriented towards a particular type of song? I mean, one of the great mysteries of the Beatles is that Lennon and McCartney are credited for writing all the songs together, and it's only through anecdotal tales or brief interviews where you might find out that Paul really wrote the bulk, if not all, of Yesterday. John might have written the bulk of it, but you don't really know. There's not credit. It's not like, oh, this song was 70% John and 30% Paul. From what you saw, were there certain types of songs that you would say, oh, that was more a Paul song, and certain ones that you would say that was more a John song?
Well, yes, Yesterday was Paul's. I mean, so many, you can tell Paul. I mean, you know a Paul song. You know a Paul and John song. You don't have to give credit to 70% or 20% or whatever, because they were a team. You know, it's like Leonard and Bernstein or Steen. I'm not sure of how you pronounce it, but it was something that they contributed together, and you can tell which is John and which is Paul.
Mm. Did he ever dedicate one to you or write a song with you?
Well, those were not the days of dedication. Those were not. It was not necessary to dedicate anything in the early days.
Did it bother you later on that he would actually write songs that had Yoko's name in it, like "Oh Yoko" and things like that?
No, because that was John. You know, John progressed and regressed and progressed and regressed. John was John, and what he did was what he felt was necessary. You know, any artist of any worth has to go through their lives, and it's never a wonderful, happy life to be as people call him, a genius. You know, most geniuses have very tortured lives because they have to be very, very self-centered.
In case the folks missed the earlier news flash, ABC News has confirmed that John Lennon, a member of the famed Beatles, may be the best-known member, was shot twice in the back outside of his apartment building in the west side of New York tonight, rushed to the Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. An unspeakable tragedy. Details on Nightline.
Well, continuing our conversation here with Cynthia Lennon, former wife of John Lennon, on today, December 8th, the 25th anniversary of the death of the former Beatle.
If you're so worried about my effect on the kids, don't publicize it. Stop asking me about them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's a game. Mm-hmm. It's a game for anybody to ask me about my feelings on drugs and then put me down for talking about it.
Right.
If they don't want it to spread round, stop writing about it and stop asking people like me whether they take drugs or not.
You talk a little bit in the book about drugs and how they influenced not only your husband but the rest of the Beatles in the latter part of the Beatles' career. Tell us when you first became aware that the drugs were an issue and a problem.
Well, I think, it's pretty well documented that, you know, we were given drugs in coffee after a meal with George and Patty. And that was the beginning, as far as I could see, because I didn't know what they were doing beforehand, or apart from in Hamburg, yes, they were taking amphetamines and drinking a lot of beer and staying up all night and working all night. But when the actual serious heavy drugs came into view, I remember this one guy coming from America, believe it or not, with a load of LSD. I knew nothing about it, but I found out about it later. And while we were away, my mother put it down the toilet.
Mm.
I know it's not funny, but I was so worried at the time that it would affect the water supply in Great Britain and have everybody
would be high in Great Britain. Yeah. I don't think that's how it works.
Not funny at all, really. Yeah. But that's how it started, and it sort of escalated from there.
You talk about that he actually sort of put pressure on you to take LSD and some of these other things?
He wanted me to be with him doing what he was doing, to be on his wavelength. That's why he did it, because we were drifting apart, because I couldn't understand where his head was at the time, mm-hmm. and where... what he was looking for. You know, I believed and felt that we had more than enough of what life can endow upon you. I don't know. I just felt that I was a happy person at the time. I didn't need to escape from where I was, but he obviously did, and that was why he wanted me to be on that level.
Was it a disaster when you when you tried it? Was it just a disaster?
It was a nightmare.
What happened?
Well, it was just a nightmare. I would never want to go through it again. And the awful thing about acid or LSD is that you have flashbacks. You know, and it doesn't just happen. It isn't just taking the drug and having that trip, good or bad or indifferent. It means that, you know, it definitely affects your mental state.
Hmm. And do you think that was a rift that you could never cross, that once he sort of moved into that world, you were never getting John Lennon back?
Well, I couldn't. How could I? I mean, I was fighting something that was beyond my capabilities of changing. Because when somebody's mind is being, I don't know how to put it, being changed mm-hmm. on a chemical level, you know, the physical level and the normal level is it's impossible. And I found it impossible.
I am the walrus. Could you, Mr. City Policeman, sitting pretty little, please?
Nothing is real. Nothing to get on about. Strawberry feels forever.
Why do you think he got so deeply involved in drugs? You said before, you know, he obviously wanted to escape, and most people listening would say, gosh, if I got to be a Beatle, I'd want to enjoy every minute of it.
Yeah, well, I think the pressure, as we talked about earlier, I think the pressure got too much for John, and I think this is, of course, is only my point of view, is that he had so much pain inside him that he wanted to escape that pain.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that this was an easy way out, and there's no easy way out.
Do you think the drugs and Yoko Ono's willingness to get involved with that world and your reticence to do so is also part of what attracted him to her and ultimately kept him with her?
Oh, well, absolutely, yes, absolutely, because I think he made one comment about the fact that Yoko was more like a man, a mate. You know, I mean, somebody who was prepared to go through all that sort of experimental stuff with him, and they did.
After you and John broke up, you detail in the book, the song Hey Jude was actually written by Paul McCartney as a sort of, I don't know, a healing gesture for that. Is that right?
Well, I think, you know, Paul was the only person out of all of them that actually made an effort to come and see me after it had all blown up, and it was obvious to everybody that John was with Yoko and Julian and I were left behind.
Mm.
So he drove to our home in Weybridge in Surrey and brought a red rose and commiserated with me. But en route to coming to see me, he wrote, Hey Jules it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then he changed it to Hey Jude.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better.
Which now is, which is so wonderful. It's an anthem, virtually.
Right, and yet it was a song actually written out of heartbreak of some sort. And did he play it for you when he came to see you?
No, he didn't. I didn't even know about it. I mean, he didn't mention that he'd written this song. I mean, they didn't talk like that, you know. Oh, I've just driven over Sin and I've written this song for Julian. No, it didn't work like that.
Mm.
What he did was he jested with me about, you know, okay, Sin, you know, shall we get married and really blow everybody's brains? Which I thought, I mean, at least he made me laugh, you know, after all the horror that had been going on. He'd actually written this for Julian, I thought was very, very special.
Did he maintain contact with you? Was he under any pressure, any of the other guys in the Beatles, to stay away from you after John got involved with Yoko?
I don't believe anyone can put any pressure on anybody if they want to do something, you know? And as far as the boys were concerned, nobody could tell them, don't go and see Sin. I think the whole thing was, I mean, it was not only a divorce from me, but it was a divorce from the Beatles themselves. So I think they were going through absolute horrors about where they were going to do and where they were going to go and what they were going to do in the future when all this happened. I mean, it really was a frightening situation for all of them.
One more break. We'll continue here with Cynthia Lennon, who has penned the book John, about her time with John Lennon. Our guest here on the Mitch Albom program. We'll continue with her right after this.
John Lennon was brought to the emergency room shortly before 11 p.m. He was dead on arrival.
Dr. Stephen Lynn of New York City's Roosevelt Hospital making the announcement that musician, composer, and former Beatle John Lennon is dead.
On a cold December evening, I was walking through the Christmas time when a stranger came up and asked me if I had heard John Lennon die. And the two of us went to this bar and we stayed to close the flames. And every song we played was for the late, great Johnny Ace.
Tell me, how did you find America?
Turn left to Greenland.
No, I mean, if people wanted to think of us as freaks, we'll be freaks for them. And if they want to think of us as musicians, we'll be musicians for them. And if it's like your lyrics, what do they mean? Anything you like, you know. And we'll be Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, or Jesus and Mary, or anything anybody wants to be, if we can get the message over.
Today, the 25th anniversary of the death of John Lennon, we're visiting with Cynthia Lennon, John's former wife, author of the book John. Did you have the opportunity in the years after the Beatles broke up to speak with any of them with regard to the notion that Yoko Ono somehow was dividing point that ultimately crumbled the band? I mean, that's obviously a theory that people talk about and Beatles fans
I think I really believe that Yoko was a catalyst to... I think they were all virtually at this point, after losing Brian... they were more or less ready to go in their own directions. It just needed something like Yoko to make it happen, and that's what happened.
Parents were bankers and all that jazz, very straight. They were trying to get her off with an ambassador when she was about 18. You know, now's the time. Yeah. You know, you married the ambassador, and we get all settled. I come from a upper working class family in Liverpool, the other end of the world. We met, but our minds were so similar. Our ideas were so similar, it was incredible that we could be so alike from different environments.
And after, as we spoke about the whole incident where you found them together and after the divorce, what was your contact at that point with John? What was Julian's contact with them during the remaining decade or so that he lived?
Well, very, very sparse for me, but I did, the one thing that I made sure I did was to get John and Julian back together. So as soon as I knew that he was not with Yoko, he was with May Pang. I didn't know what May Pang was like until I met her. But I felt that, I mean, before that, it was impossible, absolutely impossible. So when I took him over to America to meet John, when I took Julian over to see John again for the first time after 4 years, I was really happy that they could actually talk together and be together and get to know each other again.
And Julian was about how old at that point?
Do you know, you're asking me numbers.
Well, when was Julian born?
I think you should, pardon? 1963.
Okay, so he would have been about 11 years old.
Yeah.
So what was that like? I mean, an 11-year-old hasn't seen his father since he was 7. What was that initial meeting like?
Well, it was terrifying, and it was also very wonderful at the same time. You know, because they didn't really know each other. They'd lost contact. Julian didn't know what his father looked like or what he was, how he was going to react when he saw him. And John was terrified because he had a little boy that he hadn't seen for 4 years, and he had a lot of guilt. But it didn't take too long before... Well, it took a while, but it didn't take too long before they actually became close again.
Mm. And finally, tell us where you were when you found out that John had been shot, how your reactions to that, and what in the immediate aftermath of that.
Well, I was staying with Maureen Starkey, Ringo's ex-wife at the time, and I was in London on business, and I took the train from where I lived to London, and I had to catch the train the following morning. So I went to bed early, and in the middle of the night, I heard this screaming and yelling and a horrendous banshee-type scream. And it was Maureen, and she virtually dragged me downstairs. She said, Ringo's on the phone. John's been shot. I thought, oh, my God. I mean, I didn't even know. I thought I was having a nightmare. I fell downstairs, answered the phone, and Ringo said, Sin, I'm so sorry, but John's been shot and he's dead. So that was, I mean, how can you... Well, I'm sure everybody felt the same. But when you have a son and he's the father, that was probably the most horrendous moment of my life.
Cynthia Lennon's been our guest here. Her book is called John, of course, about her time with John Lennon. Would you say after all this that you loved him through and through? You still love him? You never stopped?
Do you know something? I love John. He's, you know, the first love is always the most important love. But I loved him for so many different reasons. I don't love him in the way I loved him when I was a student, but I love his memory and his talent.
Well, you've been very kind to come back on with us, and I feel now that I've had a chance to have the full interview that we wanted to have with you, and I thank you so much for your time and for your words in your book, John, which is very enlightening.
You're very welcome, Mitch.
Good to talk with you. Best for the holidays.
Thank you.
Cynthia Lennon, our special guest here on the Mitch Albom Program. This is the 25th anniversary of the death of John Lennon.
It's now 14 hours since John Lennon was shot here at the entrance to the Dakota Building on West 72nd Street in the center of New York. And in those 14 hours, there's been a crowd here standing in more or less silent vigil, and the flowers have been piling up at the gate. The body has been taken over town across to East 30th Street to the medical examiner's office. And the medical examiner's office told the BBC this morning that four bullets were in fact shot into John Lennon, one of which went through the body, one of which remains. It's thought that he died almost instantly. Ringo Starr arrived in the city this morning, went to the Dakota, and since then has refused to make any comment whatsoever. As for the suspect, who remained here after he had shot Mr. Lennon, he's now, at the present moment, awaiting arraignment and to be charged on first-degree murder. Nobody knows why he came to New York in the first place, or indeed what the motive was in what seems to be a totally senseless killing. I hope someday you'll join
us. And the world... I met Paul, said, do you want to join me band, you know? And then George joined. And then Ringo joined. We were just a band who made it very, very big, that's all.
You must remember this.
A kiss is just a kiss.
A fly is just a fly.
Right, and we're together.
A rose is a rose.
The years have passed so quickly. One thing I've understood. I'm only learning. Tell the trees from the world.
Album!